Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Almost every doctor who comes on this show the last dozen years talks about a wonder drug available to all, and it comes at an incredibly low price. We'll talk about it in our second half today. But first today, a new look at war. And contrary to the song, what if someone told you that war carries with it some good? It produces order, and it actually reduces violence in the long haul. It's made humanity safer and even richer. So says Ian Morris, author of War, What Is It Good For? Conflict and the Progress of Civilization from Primates to Robots. Ian Morris is the Jean and Rebecca Willard Professor of Classics and a professor of history at Stanford University. He's also a fellow of the Stanford Archaeology Center. And Ian, so good to have you. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be here.
Well, Ian, I bet most people think you're out of your mind for thinking that war produces good things. What kind of reactions are you getting to the book you've written here?
Well, a lot of different reactions.
Yeah, I bet.
There's some people who read the book and say, well, duh, you know, this is sort of obvious. And then other people, of course, who there's just no way that they're going to accept a claim like this.
And so they struggle with it right out of the gate.
Yeah, well, I think one of the big problems is that when you look at history over the really long haul, often what's happened in the long term is very, very different from the way we experience life on a day-to-day kind of basis.
Yeah. You know, the problem you have, you know, from a good old marketing standpoint, it seems to me, is that people hate your book even before they read it.
Well, yeah, some of the reviewers have said that. Writing reviews saying, I had expected or planned to hate this book. But then, actually, the reviews have all been, been very positive so far.
Strikingly, actually. Yeah, it's so interesting. Let's get to one of your central points here, Ian, and that's the number of deaths in the Stone Age versus the number of deaths in the 20th century, you know, with its world wars and Holocaust and everything else. In the Stone Age, you point out that people living then had a 10 to 20% chance of dying violently. There was just an astronomical level of violence back in those days. But in the 20th century, just a 1 to 2% chance of violent death, even with all the mayhem. How can that be?
Yeah, it's an amazing story.
Counterintuitive, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, you know, what we have to understand is that back in the Stone Age, most people are living in, or everybody's living in very tiny societies, you know, 10 or a dozen people. There's very little by way of rules or people kind of imposing order. And it's like, you know, people were people, same people as we are. And so they're falling out over things all the time. And you know, one way to think of it is, you know, like school kids or, say, like, you know, Lord of the Flies, a famous novel by William Golding. And you know, people are falling out all the time, and violence is always there as an option you can use to settle your problems. And when there's nobody to stop you from using violence, people do so. I mean, not all the time, of course, just occasionally, but enough that it produces this, due to our minds, astronomical level of violence. And then, yeah, you contrast that with the 20th century,
and
two world wars.
And people think of this endless violence with the 20th century. Two world wars, the Holocaust,
exactly,
bombs,
yeah.
Atomic
yeah,
weapons
nuclear
being
weapons used.
And, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, the reality is that the violence tends to get concentrated in these big bursts. That what happened over this 10,000-year period is people fight each other, and you start this process where one group wins a war, and it swallows the other group into the society. You get these bigger and bigger societies being formed. And the guys running these societies, they come under all this pressure that if they want to stay in charge, what they've got to do is pacify this group of people they rule. The last thing they want is everybody running around killing each other and not working and not paying taxes.
So there's a big push against violence as time goes on.
Yeah, it's a sort of selective kind of thing. You're the guys in charge of this group. You are going to want to make everybody in the group just get up in the morning, shut up, go to work, not kill each other, not burn each other's farms down. Mm-hmm. That's what you want in the world. And as the societies get bigger and bigger, so by 2,000 years ago, you've got empires like the Roman or the Han Dynasty in China with 60 million people in them. They drive the rates of death down, violent death, down and down and down. And so even though the wars between empires get bigger and more terrible than ever before, the overall effect over, it takes thousands of years for this to work out, but the overall effect is the rate of violence is going down all the time.
It's interesting. In short, what you're saying is well-behaved subjects are easier to govern and taxed than angry, murderous ones would be.
Exactly. Yeah. Which, when you think about it, this is common sense. And the result of this, though, has been that, you know, over 10,000 years, the rates of violent death have come down by 90%. And you know, this seems kind of and it's all been driven basically by war, which seems like a shocking, upsetting kind of argument to make. But seems to me, if we want to continue this trend, if we want to see a more peaceful world in the 21st century, we have to understand what has caused this process. You look at history, you see right away, nobody's ever been able to wish war out of existence. But on the other hand, people have been really good at responding to the payoffs you get from violence. And as violence has paid off less and less, because you get governments that will throw you in jail or kill you if you turn violent, people have become less violent.
Well, in fact, one of your points in this book, one of your concluding points, is that eventually war will fade away naturally. Because why?
Well, I guess I conclude eventually war might fade away. I think there's you can see this trend towards the lower rates of violent death, and you can identify the forces that have driven it, and you can see all kinds of ways why they are likely to continue in the 21st century. But I think one of the big things you learn from looking at history is that nothing is ever inevitable, and all you can really talk about is the probabilities of something happening. And I think the probability is that we are moving toward a more and more peaceful world. But the risk is there that it will all go abruptly wrong. And now, of course, we've got weapons more terrible than the world has ever seen before. And so if things go seriously wrong, the risk, it's a possibility we could annihilate ourselves altogether.
Well, in fact, you begin your book with a little anecdote about the possibility that how close we came not all that long ago to doing just exactly that. Tell us that story.
Yeah,
it's a great story.
This was back in 1983, more than 30 years ago, when there was a malfunction in the Soviet missile defense system. And fortunately, the guy who had designed the computer algorithms that ran the system was the guy who happened to be on duty at the main base that night. And so the system tells him that the US has launched a missile from Montana. And he looks at this and he has to make this decision. Do I pass this up the chain of command to the general secretary who's got his finger on the button?
Yuri Andropov, at that point.
Frankly, the guy was bedridden. He was totally paranoid. He was a disaster. And Pietrov, the guy in charge of the system, decides, okay, this cannot be real. If there were really a nuclear war beginning, the US would have launched thousands of missiles all at once. They would try to overwhelm our missiles while they're still in their silos. They wouldn't launch one missile. So he says, false alarm, cancel the whole thing. And so everything goes quiet. And then a couple of minutes later, all the lights on the screen start coming on again. The system's malfunctioned again. But he went with his gut and decided this cannot be right. And actually, there's a big debate over whether he really did save the world, because there's like 12 layers above him this would have to go through before anything actually happened. But alarming story.
What a moment that occurred just 30 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things often I think we don't realize is that the peak of nuclear weapons was in 1986. There were 70,000 warheads in the world. But now, for every 20 warheads there were in 1986, now there's one. We no longer, and by next year there'll be a lot less than that, we no longer have enough nuclear weapons to kill everybody. And maybe it's not a very cheerful way to put things.
But I've always thought that was always the cliche. We could all die many times over because of the nuclear warheads we have stockpiled now, but you're saying that's not the case.
Well, even at the very worst point, the US would regularly run these war games. They hire these consultants to tell them, what do you think is going to happen if the balloon goes up, worst case scenario? And the most popular estimates were that in worst case scenario in the mid-1980s, probably something like 500 million people die in the first couple of days, which is, three or four times as many as in World War II.
Yeah.
And then another 500 million in the week or so after that. And then it became very difficult to predict how many hundreds of millions more would die in the following weeks. And it's possible we had enough weapons at that point to destroy humanity altogether. But not absolutely certain. But if there had been a war at that point, it would have been the end of anything that we would recognize as civilization.
We're visiting with author Ian Morris from Stanford University. His new book, War, What Is It Good For? Conflict and the Progress of Civilization from Primates to Robots. We're talking about this paradoxical idea that war might have some good points to it. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, that's 816-235-2888. And you can see see and hear Ian Morris speak this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch at 14 West 10th Street downtown. To grab a seat, go to kclibrary.org. Again, that's at 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the branch downtown. Your second key point in this book, Ian, is that war is the only way we can produce larger, more peaceful societies, and you give the U.S. and the genocide of the Native Americans here as an example of that. Explain that one to me.
Yeah, I think this is the most depressing of the conclusions that I felt I came to from doing the research on this book, that the world would be a much better place if, instead of fighting, people could just sort of sit down and say, OK, you know, we could make our society way better if we all got together and we, you know, dream up some rules about who will enforce the law and what the excises and customs will be on trade and all these kinds of, if we just sat down and talked about it. But you look over the, you know, the 5,000 years of documented history, it's really hard to find convincing examples of people having done that, of forming these bigger societies without fighting along the way. And I think this European kind of a 500 years war that the Europeans wage on the rest of the world from roughly 1415 to 1914. But by the end of that, Europeans and their colonists have taken over 84% of the surface of the world. And the U.S., of course, is part of this. Europeans come out, settle on the East Coast, spread out all the way to the Pacific. And the society, I mean, you compare the U.S. today with what North America was like, say, 500 years ago, before there was any significant European settlement in the northern part. And U.S. today is much more peaceful, much more prosperous. People live much longer. And all kinds of measures. Life has gotten better for people, the people who are living in North America. But, of course, to get here, we went through these genocidal wars against a native population and huge arguments over just what the death toll was. But probably, you know, something like three-quarters of the native population, at least three-quarters, is wiped out. And a lot of this not deliberately done by the Europeans. And most of the deaths were through diseases that followed on from the arrival of the Europeans. But, of course, if you're one of the natives, it doesn't much matter whether this is deliberate or not. You know, three-quarters or more of your people die, your civilization is completely destroyed. And what happened to the U.S. is kind of an extreme case. But this is the basic pattern we see over and over again. Conquest, horrible numbers of deaths, a great spike up in violence. Then you come back a couple of hundred years later, and everybody involved, the conquerors and the conquered, seem to be better off, have a more peaceful world and often a more prosperous world as well.
But that obviously might not apply to the Native Americans in this country, who a lot of people would say continue to suffer enormously here in this country.
Yeah, yeah. Again, I think when you're looking at these problems, there's all these different ways you can try to measure these things and talk about them. And what some people will point out is, of course, compared to life as a Native American 500 years ago, even in the worst of the reservations today, people do live longer, have more material goods than they did 500 years ago. But then the question is, of course, look at the price they paid for this.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you conclude about humankind's inability to talk to each other, to work our way through these conflicts as you look back through history going back many, many centuries here? I mean, what does that say about us? What does it say about the whole point of the UN if that's where we're at?
Yeah, I guess I would say it's not an inability to talk things through. It's just that the kind of animals we evolved to be, we have violence there as an option. And under some circumstances, like the circumstances that prevail through most of human history, people regularly turn to violence to solve their problems. And then the big story across the last 10,000 years has been that this is getting less and less common, that you use violence. And the UN, I mean, I'm actually a big fan of the UN. I think it's done tremendous things around the world. Mm-hmm. Just that the one thing it's not very good for, and people were kind of crazy to think it would be good for, is solving security problems, because it doesn't have any force at its own disposal. So, Russia invades Crimea, say. What what can the UN possibly do about this?
Yeah.
And so for that sort of security problem and persuading people not to use violence, then having somebody like the US, who has basically a big stick, that I think is ultimately the foundation of a more secure world. But because what the UN has done is build on the security that's been provided by American power around the world,
yeah,
and intervene in all kinds of ways to make the world a better place.
So what you're saying here then are that people like the Europeans come to this continent, the Native Americans are already here. There's this notion of the groups can't assimilate, and a feeling that the Native Americans aren't willing to give up their freedom. No group wants to voluntarily give up their freedom. So the collision is almost, it will follow almost naturally by itself.
Yeah, I guess the way I would put it is that there's always a really high risk that it's going to turn violent, that there's misunderstandings between groups. People want different things. Regularly they're going to start thinking, well, you know, this just isn't going the way we wanted. Maybe we need to act violently. And I mean, say if you look at something like the history of Jamestown or something we know quite a lot about, you look at what happened there, there's long periods of cooperation between the English settlers, the British settlers, and the native populations. But then every so often it just gets out of control. And it seems like both sides are probably roughly equally as much to blame in this. But you get some people who say, we don't want war, we don't want violence, but we're in this situation where it looks like violence is not the worst of the options anymore.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope is the ultimate outcome, the ultimate purpose of your book? Because certainly from an ethical standpoint, so many folks listening will listen to your well-reasoned argument and still walk away and conclude that war is horrible, unethical. We don't ever want to go there. And so you're offering up what here? Just a perspective of where we've been and what we are, or where are you here?
Yeah, well, I think the people who walk away saying war is horrible are absolutely right. I mean, war is a disastrous way to do things. And yet, you look back at history, this is the major mechanism we've used to create these bigger societies that ultimately create a safer world.
That's so interesting.
So, yeah, and I think, I mean, I'd like to help people understand how we've gotten into this safer world. I think there's a real problem if you don't understand what the processes have been of just saying, well, we need to get rid of war, and thinking you can wish war out of existence. Nobody's ever been able to do that. I think the way to control these dark, destructive forces is by understanding what the story has been.
The Good Side of War, that's our topic today. Ian Morris is our guest. He's the author of War, What Is It Good For? Our number, 816-235-2888. Option 2 is to send us an email to update@kcur.org. He speaks tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch downtown. Just send an email to kclibrary.com. Go to kclibrary.com to get more information about the event tonight. Point number three you make here, Ian, one of your central points that undergirds this book is this notion that war can make nations richer. How so?
Yeah, again, I think this is something that's kind of a sort of a common sense thing when you step back and think about it for a minute, that if it's right that war has driven the formation of these bigger, safer societies, then once the world starts to become more safe and more predictable, it's way easier to have a more sophisticated division of labor, bigger markets, longer trade routes. And I think the Roman Empire is a classic example of this. Yeah, the Romans go out, they conquer France, they conquer the Balkans, terrible bloodshed, massive amounts of violence. But then you come back, say, two centuries later, and you look and you see, well, these are really prosperous provinces now. By the standards of the ancient world, living standards are high. The Romans use a lot of violence, but they bring peace as a consequence of this, and trade grows on the back of that.
What does all this say, your theories here about the history of humankind, about the struggles we have in this country with different cultures, people of different skin colors, trying to live together under the umbrella of the United States of America?
Yeah, I think when you look at the stories of war, people are able to fight over just about anything. So pretty much anything can set off conflicts that can turn violent. And I think one of the things the US has been so tremendously successful at is creating a situation where it's less likely that, say, cultural differences, skin colour differences, will lead to violence, and it is in a lot of other countries. And obviously there have been plenty of occasions when it's, US has been very unsuccessful in this. Yeah. But compared to most countries, it's done a very good job. And I think you could extend this, actually, and say while the big story in history has been how the formation of governments has created safer societies, not all governments are equally good at doing this. And on the whole, democracies are much better than other forms of government at getting people to say violence is not going to solve our problems.
Yeah. Ian, your theories about war, you point out in the book that you're hardly the first person to sort of broach this idea. Who first espoused this idea?
Well, people have been arguing about this really since ancient times. You find all kinds of debates in ancient Greek philosophy and ancient Chinese literature. But the sort of modern version of it really goes back about 350 years to Thomas Hobbes in the 17th century, who was living through the English Civil War. And Hobbes sees society falling to pieces around him. 100,000 of his fellow countrymen get killed over 20 years. And he asks himself, what the heck is going on here? Why does this happen? And in his day, we didn't really have much evidence to go on, but he kind of reasons his way to the conclusion that what's happened here is that the government has fallen to pieces. And once the government fell to pieces, there's nobody to enforce the laws anymore. Might becomes right. People go out and try to use force to get what they want in the world. Mm. And so he's thinking about this, and this leads him to this conclusion that the creation of governments was in fact what changed human history. He has his famous line about before the rise of governments, the life of man was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. He says, the only thing that can turn that around is the rise of what he called Leviathan, named after a really scary monster in the book of Job in the Old Testament. And he says, when you get governments as terrifying as Leviathan, that will basically scare us straight and we'll stop thinking we can go around killing each other, because now we know that there's this government there that's going to come round and it's got way more force at its disposal than you or I have.
Huh. Has Ian Morris convinced you? Are there some good aspects to war or not? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. It's interesting to me, Ian, that you wrote in this book that even 10 years ago, you never would have believed that you would write a book that would argue that a form of mass murder, war, is in some ways good. So what happened? How'd you get here?
I think I started thinking about this problem with a result of an earlier book I was writing called Why the West Rules for Now, which was this long-term history of East and West, comparing them. And I realized that every time there's a really big change in the story and something dramatic happens, it's always accompanied by massive amounts of violence. And so I started saying, why is this? Why do we have to do things this way? And so this is what led me into researching this book. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that this long-term story is actually fairly clear that, despite all the horrors of war, constantly people keep going back to violence to try to solve their problems. Mm-hmm. But over the long run, there has been this decline in the use of violence. And so this seemed to me something that we have to explain.
Is there one society, one civilization that you think that illustrates this the most clearly of all the different ones you've looked at for this book?
Yeah, I guess I would say the ancient Roman Empire, I think, is a really good example. It's so extremely violent. And then for at least a couple of centuries, say the first two centuries AD, it's probably the most peaceful and prosperous part of the pre-modern world. And actually, modern Europe is, again, another really good example, because Europe, for a very long time, Europe was the kind of epicenter of world violence, setting off these wars that ripple out around the world. And now in the European Union, you've got the lowest rates of violent death the world has ever seen, some of the highest rates of prosperity.
Huh. Let's go to some phone calls here. Let's go to Richard from Overland Park. Richard, you're on Up to Date with Ian Morris. Good morning.
Hi, guys. Great topic. Simple question for the author and I guess the audience is, discuss the different philosophies that nations had when they conquered land. Like, I know the Mongols were different from the Carthaginians, which were different from the Romans, and how that might have had long-lasting effects. And I'll listen off the air if he understands the question.
Yeah, thank you, Richard.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, a great question. Because, like you say, you see these totally different attitudes about why people are going to war and what they think they're going to get out of it. And one of the things that really surprised me as I was going back to, you know, these huge annals we've got about all the wars, was how, in a way, the reasons people were fighting the wars often had very little to do with the outcomes of the wars. That there's a very paradoxical kind of relationship going on. That you know, in some ways, you can say that this European colonial expansion, in some ways, was... The long-term effect of this produced more peace than any other war that had ever happened. But on the other hand, some of the things the Europeans did and the motives they had for going out to the rest of the world were among the worst the world has ever seen. So, yeah, huge variety of motives, often very separate from the outcomes. But the kinds of societies that you get during the conquest, so that I mean, like, say, you talked about the Mongols. With people like the Mongols, these steppe nomads coming out of Central Asia, their big problem was that once they conquered an area, they really were not in much of a position to impose a stable government. And their conquests actually tended to have the opposite effect from the big story, making the world, you know, breaking things up, basically, and killing even more people.
That's interesting. Let's go to some more calls. Eric from Kansas City, Missouri. Eric, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
My question for the author is to take his argument to its logical conclusion that larger violent wars lead to larger, more peaceful societies. Would we, to take that to its end, does that mean, you know, a very large war would create a one world government where it'd be the most largest peaceful society we would see? That's my question.
That's a great question, Eric.
Yeah. I think Eric has put his finger on another of the really big paradoxes in the story. I think, you know, if you were a space alien and you came to Earth and you had total recall of all the history, I think you would agree with Eric. This is the logical conclusion. One more great war produces world government, safest, richest world you can imagine. Mm-hmm. But of course, the problem is, with the weapons we've now got, one more great war conceivably leads to no people left at all, which I suppose is peace in a way, but not quite what we might be looking for. And so toward the end of the book, this is the problem I try to wrestle with. And I guess the way I've come to think about this is that, you know, the big thing driving the decline in violence has been this, the way that the creation of governments raised the costs of violence and lowered the payoffs from violence. So people respond by using violence less and less. And I think in a way you can say that since nuclear weapons came into the world, for the great powers, the potential cost of turning violent now has risen to infinity. Everybody dies. This is a disaster. And a sort of uplifting part of the story, in a way, is that, you know, in the Cold War, we didn't, in the end, use nuclear weapons. By the 1980s, the Soviet leadership, for all its problems, they'd realized that force was not going to solve the difficulties they'd got. Yeah. And the results that they got, because, yeah, as Vladimir Putin likes to point out, it didn't end very well for the Soviet Union. But compared to blowing everybody up, the end was quite good. And so this is one of the main reasons why I am fairly optimistic. I think, you know, we can't wish war out of existence, but we are very, very good at recognizing and responding to these changing payoffs. And I think, you know, while there's no certainties, the probabilities are that we will continue in this direction, more and more integration around the world, but without having to have one last great war.
You know, Ian, you make another argument here, and that is, in more contemporary terms, that the U.S. must continue to threaten those who rock the boat around the globe and even attack them when necessary for the greater good. The alternative, you point out, would be a return of widespread, low-level war that would end up killing far more people.
Yeah. I think one thing I found really useful for thinking about the situation in the world today was to look back, you know, 100, 150 years to the late 19th century, when you've got a situation that's a little bit similar in some ways. That the British Empire at that point, it doesn't rule the world, you know, no more than the US now rules the world. But it does act as a kind of globocop. It polices an international order. It makes its money, basically, like the US does, off these these global flows of trade. And the British have got this financial and naval dominance that allows them to deter a lot of other powers from fighting wars. Not all powers, obviously, but a lot of them. And the world slides into World War One basically because the British cease to be able to do this anymore. And I would say that the big threat in the world today is that some of the trends suggest the US might be rerunning the British script from 100 years ago. And if that is what's happening, then perhaps 30 or 40 years from now, the US is no longer going to be able to deter people from using force to settle their problems. I mean, some would say we're already beginning to see that with the invasion of Crimea as a sort of classic example of this, perhaps. And the more that people use force, the greater the risk becomes of this just spiraling way out of control, with, of course, nuclear annihilation as a possible endpoint.
Ian Morris will continue this conversation tonight at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, downtown, 14 West 10th Street. More information and to get a seat, kclibrary.org. What an interesting conversation, interesting argument. Ian, what a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you. It's been great to be on
the
show.
Thanks so much. Ian Morris, again, has been our guest. He's the author of War, What Is It Good For? Conflict and the Progress of Civilization.